You're listening to Non-Zero World. I'm your host, Connor Eccles. Each week, I break down the latest developments in U.S. foreign policy and other global news, and I interview a leading expert or activist. To gain access to full-length episodes and other exclusive content, become an NZN member today at Robert Wright's Non-Zero newsletter at nonzero.org.
Hey, Barry, how you doing?
Hey, Connor, I'm good. How are you?
Pretty good. Why don't I go ahead and get us introduced? So I am Connor Eccles, the managing editor of Non-Zero and the host of this, which is Non-Zero World, the weekend edition of the Non-Zero podcast. You are Barry Eisler, best-selling spy novelist, but here to talk about a slightly different novel that you have out right now. I should note, in terms of previous series that people might know about, you wrote the John Rain series, the Livy Alone series. Am I missing any big ones there?
Four different series, but Livia and John Rain are probably my best known. And yeah, the previous books have been driven more by, we were just talking about this before we started recording, I would say they're driven more by extraordinary government skullduggery. And this book, The System, is driven more by ordinary government skullduggery. That's
right,
one
exactly.
Book reference.
Yeah, so it's a very interesting book, and I guess maybe I should give people a little bit of a sense of what it is about. We'll try to avoid too big of spoilers because people should go out and buy it. It's a fun read. Got it right here. Barry was kind enough to send a copy. But the basic thing is we follow our hero, Congresswoman Valeria Velez, as she tries to transition from a anti-war and sort of progressive campaign to being an actual anti-war and progressive member of Congress. And as you might guess, the odds are stacked against her. There are many different actors within the system that are trying to slow her down, trying to push back and sort of create a situation where she is unable to pursue an effort to pull back on militarism and things like that. So it's very interesting. It's very much engaged with the reality, I think, of a lot of what happens in DC. And I'll get you to maybe define what you mean by the title in a second. You know, The System, it's obviously sort of a broad thing, but first I think it might be useful for people to get a little bit more on your background and how you came to sort of shift in your views, I presume, I guess at least, because you started your career in the clandestine service of the CIA, if I'm correct, right?
Yeah, that's right. I spent 3 years in a covert position in the CIA. It was only 3 years, and it was quite a few years ago. I think at this point, my God, it was over 30 years ago. So I wouldn't call myself some kind of super expert on the secret world and the clandestine services and all that. But one thing that I did learn, among a few others, while I was in CIA is this. That the notion that the way to understand politics in America is primarily through a left-right or Democrat, Republican, liberal, conservative prism is increasingly antiquated, and it's always been somewhat distorted. And what I mean by that, especially with regard to the CIA, is I would say that many, if not most, of the people I knew at CIA were socially liberal. They may have voted Democrat, didn't really come up that much, at least not as I recall. And I myself have never been particularly a fan of either wing of the party. But the real political ideology that I encountered and that I shared when I was at the CIA is this notion of America as a force for good in the world. And when we use force, it's for beneficent reasons, generous reasons even. If you don't believe that, you're probably going to have a hard time in the American security services, I would say. So this is a foundational belief. If you think about the stuff that we're all inculcated with, starting when we're children, the notions of manifest destiny, if you read a bit of American history and American exceptionalism, city on a hill, light unto nation, the indispensable nation, the last best hope of mankind, all this kind of stuff is just very much a part of American political culture. And sure, certain like left-right viewpoints will get layered on top of this, but the foundation is, as I just described, and that's a foundation that I imbibed growing up in America, and that I took with me into the CIA. I didn't even really notice it that much at the time, because I guess you could say I was like the proverbial fish in water. The fish doesn't really notice the water. This was just axiomatic stuff. Nobody would question it. Truth, justice in the American way and all that. It was only later in life that I started to try to develop more of an outsider's perspective on my own political and cultural assumptions. And it's funny, I hadn't thought of this before, but probably this process started when I first lived in Japan. I wound up spending about 4 years in Japan, nothing to do with the CIA. This was all after I'd left. But that experience of living in a quite different culture gave me a sort of stereo vision or binocular vision on my own culture, certain things that, certain assumptions I'd had before going over there about why America is the best country, or at least the better country, and what it must be like everywhere else. I started questioning those things. And by coincidence, that was the time when I started to work on the manuscript that became my first book, A Clean Kill in Tokyo. Anyway, so that's my political evolution, is one I would describe as one that started with just basic, unconscious, inculcated American assumptions, and that over time has resulted in what I might describe as more of a Martian's perspective. Like, how would a Martian see this? And I think you get much more accurate results if you try to see your own culture the way an outsider, for me, a Martian, something I borrowed from Noam Chomsky, the way a Martian would see it. I think you get those more accurate results.
Yeah, it'll be no secret to non-zero listeners that we agree with that, you know, broad framing. Even our Friday newsletter is called The Earthling, yeah. And it's a little bit like that, right? It's a little bit that idea that, you know, you're trying to look at things from as sort of, I don't know if materialist or like is quite the right word, but from a point of view that analyzes things through the lens of incentives, through the lens of sort of ideally realities on the ground more than
taking yourself more than, yeah, out of it. And it's funny, two great passions of mine are power and politics on the one hand, and the craft of writing fiction on the other. The system's my 19th novel, and I've written a bunch of short stories and screenplays too. So it would be strange to do what I do for a living and not have an interest in the craft. And one of the best ways to understand your own characters, to try to get inside their heads, something I learned from a guy named Robert McKee, who, if anyone's interested in fiction, writing fiction, McKee's first book is just called Story. Really good book on the craft of, well, telling stories. McKee says the proper way to understand your characters is not to ask, what would the character do? And it isn't to ask, what would I do? It's to ask, what would I do if I were this character? And it's a little bit of a paradox there, because you're, on the one hand, you're trying to put yourself into another person's mind and their worldview, but without undue influence based on your own ideology, your own worldview, your own values. But you're trying to really, well, you might say, cognitively empathize with that character. That is the right way to approach your own characters. And it's not a bad way to understand the way other people, other cultures look at our actions. And that's something I try to do in all these things. So, you know, and recently, just as one of countless examples, when Pete Hegseth, or no, actually this is different. This was Vice President Vance said that we're not at war with Iran, we're at war with Iran's nuclear program. That is something that Americans might be able to convince themselves of. I think it's a little bit of a stretch, right, but I can see where Americans might be able to see it that way. But I doubt there's a single Iranian who sees it that way. And there was a meme going on or on Twitter, and it was funny and on point. It was something from like Admiral Hirohito, or Emperor Hirohito, or Admiral Yamamoto at the outset of World War II, right after the bombing of Pearl Harbor. We're not at war with America, we're at war with America's base in Hawaii or something. And of course, no American would see it that way, or did see it that way, or could see it that way. That's the kind of thing where I'm like, I see you see this as an American. How would you be looking at this if you were an Iranian, putting yourself in that other person's shoes and worldview? It's a very important skill in life, I think, because it'll get you better results, again, both with your characters and with geopolitics.
Right. And I think that does really, I think the idea of cognitive empathy, you mentioned it explicitly. You mentioned Robert Wright, of course, Bob, the normal host of the regular edition of this podcast, who has talked about that a lot in his book, Why Buddhism is True, and in his frequent public writing, this idea that, you know, you kind of sort of need to put yourself in the shoes of the people that you're analyzing in order to provide better analysis. And looking at that does not mean that you agree with them. It simply means you're trying to understand. And I think that really kind of comes through in the book in the way that you have all these different characters that play different roles in what we could call the system, right? These different characters who you've got sort of the member of Congress that Valeria defeats and then sort of turns around and starts to sort of help her, but help himself. You know, you've got all of these different people, and you actually do what I think is a fundamentally empathetic take on how they approach these things. It's not, maybe with one exception, there are no characters that are like true full villains, right?
Even the one I think you're thinking of, to me, is not, I mean, he plays a villainous role.
Right.
But I do understand his formative experiences and his world. It's a coherent, it is an absolute zero sum worldview.
Right.
And I understand it. I don't agree with it, but I understand where he's coming from.
Right. And he, well, so that is interesting. So why don't we go ahead? Maybe this is a good time for you to just describe exactly what you mean by the system. Like what are these sets of forces that are acting upon Valeria as she comes into Congress that make it challenging for her to pursue essentially anti-war politics?
Yeah. So I should start by saying that all my novels are intended to entertain. If they don't entertain, then they just don't succeed as novels. And feedback has been pretty good over the years, so I think they do entertain. And so on the most fundamental level, the book is about Valeria Velez, who's not yet 30 years old and has just been elected in an improbable upset to represent California's 27th district in Congress. And she defeated a 10-term corporatist incumbent. Parties are not mentioned in the book, except in the epigraphs I used to introduce each chapter. But you could imagine Valeria as being of either what I think of as wings of a duopoly, a single party, not two different parties. But you can imagine her as anything you want. The point is, she has campaigned on a platform of we're going to stop stuffing the maw of the military machine. We're going to implement a universal basic income. We're going to return power to the people. Immediately, this is chapter one, the Pentagon, which she has really campaigned against, announces that it's going to move its next generation air dominance program, NGAD program, out of Air Force Plant 42 in Palmdale, California. That's in Valeria's new district. They're going to move it to Fort Worth Air Force Plant 4 and build the NGAD fighters there. That's going to put 5,000 of Valeria's constituents out of work immediately and certainly render her a one-term congresswoman, a one-hit wonder. And we get into some interesting character things because I have to build layers of my character and her psyche in such a way that the notion of being a one-hit wonder for various reasons to Valeria is horrifying. And she is going to have to decide between being true to her political values on the one hand, and success in politics on the other. So what is the system here? The system is how it all works together, how power is really exercised in America, not the veneer, but the actual power. And for anybody who wants to go deep on this stuff, deep in the sense of a deep state, there's a historian named Aaron Good I've gotten friendly with, who's just terrific. I read his book, American Exception. I'm really proud that Aaron had some kind things to say about the system. We had a good conversation about it. Aaron's book, American Exception, isn't about Democrats and Republicans, except superficially. It's about the deeper forces that acquire, maintain, and are relentlessly trying to expand their power in America. So what are these forces? I think of them as centers. You've got obviously the Pentagon, what Eisenhower called the military industrial complex. Yes, you have Washington, like the formal instruments of power, Congress, the White House, the Supreme Court, Wall Street, Silicon Valley, the media, all these different elements are subsystems always jockeying for power. And it's funny to think that the framers, quite cleverly, I think, you know, with some flaws, no disrespect, it's done pretty well for about 250 years. That's a good run. The idea of three co-equal branches of government that would all jealously guard their prerogatives, their power, such that a balance would be maintained in the system overall. I think this is true also for the way these deeper forces operate. And this is something I've tried to depict in the system. To use a real world example, if anyone here remembers, if you were following it at the time, when Dianne Feinstein, by the way, I was never a fan, just using her as an example, she had a committee that was looking into, that was investigating torture by American forces. We called it enhanced interrogation techniques, very kind way of putting it. But in any other context, again, how would the people on the other end of these enhanced interrogation techniques understand them? How would we understand them if they were being done to us? These are torture techniques, and they were always understood as such. Anyway, Senator Feinstein had a committee that was investigating torture by the CIA. Then CIA Director John Brennan had his people hack into the committee's computers to see what was going on. Feinstein learned about this, and she got very upset. And this really interested me. I actually wrote an article about this in The Guardian at the time, because I think, I still think that what was happening between Feinstein on the one hand and Brennan on the other was misunderstood. Feinstein gave a speech. She said, "This is outrageous. This is a violation of Executive Order 1033. It's a violation of the Fourth Amendment. It's a violation of the separation of powers." And I remember listening to the speech, and I was like, wow, she's really going to bring it. I mean, these are serious charges. And then she got to the next part, which was, "And I demand an apology." And I said, "Oh my God, that's fascinating." And I immediately thought of The Godfather and The Sopranos, right? One of my favorite movies, one of my favorite television shows. And I realized that Feinstein and Brennan are just players in a system. They respect each other. They do business together. They fight over the spoils, and one might overstep and then the other has to push back. But what she just did was she signaled to all the other players, "Hey, Brennan overstepped here. You don't go breaking into my computers. You know, we can fight rough, but that's too much. This guy needs to be straightened out. And if you all don't straighten him out, I will escalate." And then what happened was the other players stepped in and they said, "John, listen, you know, I know she's a little upset, but you did, like, come on, you're the CIA, you got caught, all right? You got to tell her you're sorry." And he's probably saying, "You know, she was doing this." And they're like, John, we get it, but it's just, it's too much. She's upset. Right. She's going to escalate. It's no good for anyone. We can't have this. Swallow your pride, make nice with her. And that's exactly what happened. There were no prosecutions. There's no further investigation. John Brennan basically said, "I'm sorry." And they all got back to business. It was a sit down, just like on The Sopranos. And if Brennan hadn't backed down, then the other players might have put more pressure on him. Who knows where it might have gone eventually. This is the way these different centers of powers actually work. And again, this is what I've tried to depict in the book. Why are we Americans so occluded to the true nature of power in America? A lot of interesting psychological questions here having to do, I think, with the kind of privilege we give our in-group, having to do with something called the fundamental attribution error, which you and Bob have written about more times than I can count, and which I think is one of the most important things to understand about what my character, Monty Cranston, my spinmeister and savant, calls the humans. If there's one thing you should understand about the humans, it's this thing, the fundamental attribution error. And since I mentioned it just quickly, it's the notion that we tend to judge ourselves, especially when we do good things, by our intentions, by our character. We're good people and we mean to do good things. And of course we do good things. And if by chance we should do a bad thing, it was some sort of mistake or accident, no reflection on our character. Whereas out-groups, particularly ones we don't like, when they do bad things, it's because they're evil. They're inherently bad. They have bad character, so of course they do bad things. If they happen to do a thing that is arguably at least good, we try to, it was either an accident or they did it for some nefarious ulterior motive or whatever. And this distortion in the way we see ourselves versus the way we see others, particularly our adversaries, creates a lot of conflict in the world. So it's a rubric I try to apply both in fiction, especially in the system, and also in my understanding of events.
Yeah. Yeah, that's very helpful. And it's worth, I guess, highlighting the ways in which, you know, because the core tension, I guess, that runs, again, through the book is this battle over whether they're going to be able to keep these jobs in Valeria's district. And it's such a thing that, you know, you'd think that, oh, maybe they do this kind of subtly. But, you know, like Lockheed Martin, for example, literally does have a website for the F-35. That is the fifth generation fighter. The NGAD is the next generation. That's the sixth generation. And for the F-35, they literally have an interactive map on the website where you can click around and you can see how many jobs are in each state and the value to the state. Right. So it's even in sort of passive ways before you even get. There's an implicit threat that, you know, careful. If you do something that might slow down the F-35, which now is going to cost over its lifetime more than $2 trillion, it's very questionable whether it's going to be particularly valuable for the types of wars that the U.S. might fight in the future. But nonetheless, we have to keep doing it because it serves these jobs in all of these districts. Absolutely. So it's just such a direct and sort of out loud way that they do it and that the system operates and puts pressure on politicians. And I'm very interested too by the point, sort of the tension, and it's kind of a more fundamental problem with the U.S. system, which is the fact that having to run every 2 years for the House really messes with your incentives. Do you have thoughts on that?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, most of what Congress people do is raising money. I mean, you can read almost any account of what it's like to be a congressperson. Most of their, I shouldn't say most. Is it over 50%? I don't know that. A tremendous amount of their time is spent raising money. And think of how that must, I mean, just what would a Martian make of this? That what is the most important determinant? Statistically, it's not 100%, but in general, who wins elections in America at every level, state, federal, all the different levels of state and federal. You can predict who will win the election with near certainty by who has raised more money. What does that say about our system, our democracy, as we like to call it? It's badly distorted. And when the federal government, particularly the military-industrial complex, is run in such a way, whether it's through PACs, political action committees, which are steering money, to various favored Congress people or other lobbies are doing the same, it's understood that if I don't take this money, and worse, if they don't like me, that particular special interest, and they direct the money to my opponent, I will almost certainly lose. And you could see this with other with powerful defense lobbies. I can't believe I just called it defense. Military lobbies. I hate propaganda. And defense is a propagandistic word. We changed the name of Harry Truman changed the name of the War Department in 1947 to the Defense Department, and it irritates me how ubiquitously the word defense is used for America's $1 trillion military budget. I mean, this can't all be for defense. We've got oceans left and right and friendly neighbors north and south. Like, what kind of, we spend 10 times as much as the next country on earth. How can this be for, what are we defending ourselves? It's just pure propaganda. But I myself occasionally fall for it. So yeah, I think a more accurate term, neutral term, is military. If you want to go a little in the other direction, you can call it war spending. But whatever, it's military spending. Anyway, what happens in a system where special interests like Raytheon or Northrop Grumman or Lockheed have tremendous amounts of money they can direct, whether through political action committees directly to a candidate, or in the form of jobs programs that they can turn on or turn off in individual districts. If you run afoul of just this one special interest, then again, not only will your lifeblood, your America, the political lifeblood in America, which is money, not only will your lifeblood, your oxygen be cut off, it will now be directed to another opponent. And you can see this recently with regard to another powerful, possibly the most powerful American lobbying group, AIPAC. There were two congresspeople they felt were insufficiently on board with AIPAC's aims. That was Jamal Bowman and Cori Bush. And they funded their Bush's and Jamal Bowman's primary opponents and defeated two sitting two sitting congresspeople in primaries, which is a very difficult thing to do. But they just steered enough money toward those challengers to make it happen. And anyone who is watching this will understand if you cross AIPAC, you really do it at your peril. What is true of AIPAC is at least as true of military lobbyists and the entire military industrial complex as well. And then we get into character questions, which I try to portray as poignantly and realistically as I can in the book. So what is the process of subornment? I'm really curious about this. I mean, I tend to think that America is governed by the worst people in the country. At least that's my observation. I mean, I haven't done a study. And maybe, you know, serial killers and child rapists are worse. That's fine. I'm not talking about individual cases, but just in general, like people who you might otherwise associate with, who haven't done anything that's overtly criminal, that's technically criminal. Why do we seem to get the worst people? And I think that's a really interesting question. Are the worst people attracted to power? I think so. And do the worst people who are then attracted to power and start to acquire power, do they become even worse the more power they acquire? I think that is also, yes, that's part of the process. And then the question is, how does it happen? And that really interests me. And that's part of what I'm trying to portray here. So you can really feel Valeria's dilemma. I mean, the rationalizations, like all the best rationalizations, are not entirely rationalizations. They're not fantastical. So on the eve of her victory party, where CNN has just announced David and Goliath candidate Valeria Velez stuns Washington, unseats 10-term corporatist incumbent Fillion Dunn. 5 minutes later, she learns that the Pentagon is moving the NGAD program out of her district. And if she doesn't campaign for those jobs, those constituents will not only not vote for her in 2 years, they'll vote against her. They'll campaign against her. And the money that she might otherwise have had to fund her campaign, it's all going to be steered to someone else. So she's going to lose. She'll be a one-term congresswoman. Well, think about it. As a one-term congressperson, can you actually accomplish anything? I mean, all the work you did to get to this point, you did it. You won the race against all odds. You're in. And now you can finally start to do some of the good things and start to act on some of the ideals that drove you and brought you to this point. But to do that, you're going to have to be in Congress. You're going to have to exercise some of the power you've just acquired and hopefully acquire more. If they turf you out of power after just one term, not only will you have gotten nothing, you will be an object lesson for anybody else who crosses these powerful interests, which, again, in the real world, you could argue that Bush and Bowman were turned into. They were turned into object lessons. For anyone who didn't understand the power of AIPAC before, they certainly understand it now. So Valeria's got, how does she grapple with that? How do you navigate this? And in a sense, this is the story engine of the system. She's going to try to resolve the dilemma. Nobody wants to choose. No one. When you have a dilemma, you don't want to have to choose. And again, back to a point of craft and fiction, many people know the idea of like an inciting incident, which to me in a story, it's like this. All stories are basically this. Once upon a time, and then one day. And here, once upon a time, an idealistic young woman, against all odds, is elected to Congress. And then one day, which here is immediately, the real power in America gives her a dilemma. You want to go to war with us? We will destroy you and turn you into an object lesson, and you will get nothing done, and you'll be humiliated. Which is it going to be? The dilemma is your ideals, or do you compromise and get a few things done? Dilemmas are the best inciting incidents. I could go on about this, but maybe another time for anyone who's really interested in craft. So Valeria has a dilemma. Do I stay true to my ideals, or do I compromise a little to try to get things that are more important? Well, the answer is compromise at least just a little. Otherwise, it'd be no story. She would just quickly be turfed out of power, and that would be the end of that. So she does try to compromise with the various factions that hold real power in America, the Pentagon, the military-industrial complex, Silicon Valley. And what happens when a politician starts compromising with power, start to gain more power, that's good. In order to get things done, you need power. You have to acquire more power. You can't get anything done. But how do you acquire power? You got to compromise. You have to treat with those different centers of power. What happens to you, to your character, to your soul? As you do that, what's the balance and how do you maintain it? I would argue that in the real world, the results are not favorable for the people who acquire the most power, who climb what Disraeli called the greasy pole all the way to the top. There's a lot of damage to the psyche and the soul to the people who get to those heights, not just, by the way, in politics, but anywhere where there's power. I recently just watched a movie called Mountainhead, which I really recommend. I don't know if anyone listening has heard about it. But it's an HBO, what do they call themselves now, Max? Just the dumbest name change in the
world. It was HBO Max to Max, back to HBO Max.
I think it's almost like they woke up one morning. And you know what? Actually, I'm gonna come back to that in 1 second, because to me, it's actually an example of the very thing we're talking about here, which is, and Twitter to X was another one where I'm just like, what are you doing? You've got a great brand name here. Everybody knows it. What is X? What does X mean? What does it stand for? Right. Anyway, what do I know? Elon Musk is a gazillionaire, and I just write stories. But anyway, Mountainhead. It's about four Silicon Valley tech bro billionaire types having a retreat at one of their mansions, Ozymandias type mansions, somewhere in Utah. And it's a really interesting story for a lot of reasons, but what struck me about it is how detached powerful people get from the rest of the world, from reality, from ordinary morality. They just start to float away from all the baseline things that ordinary, healthy, mentally, psychologically, emotionally healthy humans wouldn't even take for granted. It's like, we didn't even think about these things. We would just almost automatically do these things as social animals. These people get detached from that, and they really start believing their own bullshit. And at the end of the movie, I thought about whoever made this decision at HBO. I imagined a committee of people who are just detached from reality. And somehow they talk themselves into, you know, Max. Max is good. Max is Maximum, right? And Max is a friendly name, too. My dog was named Max when I was a kid. Call it Max. People are going to really like that. And then at some point, they got the results from the real world. And they're like, yeah, Max, not so good. Like, HBO, that was a good name. And now they're tracking backward. Anyway, it's this is a show about the power of billionaires, technology billionaires. And I think it's a pretty devastating and accurate position of what happens to people who acquire power in that realm. But it applies also, I think, to people who acquire power in other realms, including the realm of politics. So in a sense, the movie is actually depicting something that I also tried to depict in The System in a quite different realm.
Right. And I think, you know, you've kind of been arguing throughout this that maybe it's both the worst people and the worst thing in the system. But I think it's that second part that is the most worth focusing on throughout this, right? Because, you know, you kind of don't know who comes in good. And I think that like Valeria's character, actually, I think very much comes in as someone who sincerely wants to make all this change. But
she does.
But there is a certain sense in which once you enter what we're calling the system, sometimes people have called it the blob or whatever in regard to foreign policy, you've got these series of decisions to be made, these series of compromises.
Yeah.
And you've got a lot of people who both say that they want to help you and sincerely do want to help you. It's in their interest. It's in everyone's interest is kind of the idea. So you see, I mean, that's one great character in this, which is Fillion Dunn, who is the congressman that she defeats, the 10-term.
Right.
Congressman, as you mentioned, and he, you know, is prominent. He's a major deal maker, and like many members of Congress, on his way out, he has figured out his next job, which is, of course, lobbying. Surprise, surprise. So, but it's interesting to see the ways in which he's both, I think, sincerely trying to sort of help her find her legs, and views this as simply how things are done, and then at the same time is obviously acting in the interests of his future clients, which again, and people should know, like, this is not at all a hypothetical thing. They're, you know, like Mike Gallagher left Congress last year and stuck around for a few weeks, even after he knew that he was going to leave Congress when he knew that he was going to go to Palantir to work for them. And he was in a significant position. We had another case like that this year as well. So it's a thing that really happens.
Yeah. One of the things I do in my novels, and never more so than in The System, is endnotes. Because my fiction is always derived from some basis in fact. I've written a few books, prequels for my character John Rain, and set in 1972 and 82. So there I was using just real historical stuff. In the case of the first Rain prequel set in Tokyo in 1972, I used the Lockheed bribery scandal, which if you're curious, anyone who's listening, Google it. It just involved just what it sounds like, an American military contractor bribing Japanese government officials and officials in other countries too, to buy Lockheed stuff instead of from other suppliers. And it all came out in the open, involved the CIA, super interesting stuff. And I use that as that, like, I love doing this. I'm like, what was going on that didn't get revealed in the headlines? Like, where are the bodies that weren't unearthed? I really enjoy doing that as a novelist, whether it's a historical thing or something more recent. So that's, and the end notes are for anyone who wants to go deeper, or anyone who thinks that that this is some stuff I'm making up, or that it sounds fantastical. I really do wish I were making this stuff up, but much of it is based on truth. And that revolving door to and from lobbying to Congress, independent journalist Lee Fong has documented this extensively, and several of my footnotes are to Lee's work, where you just can't believe the list is long. Like, come out of Congress, it's understood if you're in Congress, maybe if you want to stay in Congress, that's fine. Then lobbying firms working with PACs, they'll steer a lot of money toward you. They'll present you with position papers. They'll make your job easy. Hey, you can just turn this into a bill. Just put your name at the bottom of it and you're done. Mm-hmm. Go home early on Friday or whatever. But in the unlikely event, and it is unlikely if you're in Congress, that you lose an election, we will welcome you in the warm, loving embrace of our seven-figure salary. So you're always going to have a home at the place you've made nice with while you're working in government. This is just a thing. And again, Lee Fong, it's F-A-N-G. I think it's Fang, but it's pronounced Fong. Lee has done a tremendous job of documenting this. So I'm indebted to him for that kind of work. And it's all on my end. I don't come up with this stuff on my own. I mean, I'm lazy. I don't want to have to use my imagination more than I have to. The truth is, reality, if you're paying attention and you're a thriller writer, reality presents you with great material every day. It's a little depressing, but like they say, when life hands you lemons and all that, you know, write a good thriller.
Yeah. Yeah, it is. It is really remarkable. And maybe this is a good time, you know, to switch to another theme that I thought is very interesting and is one that I think is often underrated in the ways in which sort of power plays out, both domestically and in terms of how we think about war, which is the idea of humiliation, right? Kind of in both directions, right? So you've got not only the feeling that the system has to humiliate its opponents, has to defeat them enduringly, but also the idea that, you know, foreign policy is obviously often driven by this feeling that we need to be dominant in response to small threats in order to humiliate our enemies and sort of control them. So can you talk about that more?
Yeah, it's a psychological thing that interests me. And my character, Montgomery Monty Cranston, who is almost supernatural spinmeister and savant, he functions in certain ways as my Greek chorus in the book, while also being, I hope, a fully realized three-dimensional character who, I mean, I find him quite poignant on the page, and reader feedback has been really gratifying in that regard also. But he talks about this stuff so that other people can understand what's happening, because Valeria is being subjected to this. Valeria has a little bit of a boxing background, and so she tends to think in terms of boxing metaphors. She stung the Pentagon early on. She got in a couple of shots, which the Pentagon was not expecting from this upstart, this nobody. What does the Pentagon have to do to demonstrate to the world? Look a little bit like Apollo Creed in the first round in the first Rocky movie. You know, Rocky knocks him down And Apollo better punish him after that, because he was just badly embarrassed, which he does try to do. This is the way power has to be exercised between and among humans, who Cranston describes. Cranston says, the humans become much easier to understand when you realize that they're basically just monkeys who've learned how to talk. And then he gives some examples. He's like, you can trace a direct line from Pearl Harbor to Hiroshima and Nagasaki, or October 7th to the obliteration of Gaza, or 9/11 to the global war on terror, what America did in the course of that war, the millions killed. And I think he's absolutely right about this. He says that it is extremely dangerous to humiliate a powerful monkey. And paradoxically, a powerless monkey can't really be humiliated. It doesn't have anything to lose. Powerful monkey has a great deal to lose. And if a less powerful, and indeed a far less powerful monkey humiliates that more powerful monkey, the more powerful monkey will commit to breathtaking acts of violence and destruction, basically to get its mojo back. I remember thinking about, this is back to Dianne Feinstein again, who, again, I'm really not interested in trying to defend Dianne Feinstein. I actually thought she was awful. And as perfect an example, an instrument of the system as you could really hope for. But it is also true that torture seemed to upset her for whatever reason, as it should upset any decent person. And so I was glad that she was investigating it. And I remember when former CIA and NSA director Michael Hayden, pretty sure it was Hayden, was talking about Feinstein and her reaction to reading classified files on torture being carried out by American forces on what we euphemistically called detainees. They were actually prisoners who just weren't charged with anything, tried or convicted of anything. They're just being held indefinitely. We call them, the euphemism is detainee because it doesn't sound that bad. Anyway, she was quite upset when she was reading these accounts. Just horrible, horrible practices. And Hayden said, it's kind of emotional. And I don't know if he came right out and said, you know, women, they're emotional, or if that was just strongly implied. And I thought about it at the time. I was like, well, a couple of things that I can say here. One is that women are emotional. They are certainly emotional. Why are they emotional? Because they're human. Humans are emotional. So to say that a woman is emotional or that women are emotional is true but misleading. They are emotional because humans are emotional. All humans are emotional. Much more emotional than we are logical. That's fundamental to human nature. Emotion is a strong force. Logic is a weak force. And the other thing I started thinking about is, what about the men who designed, planned, carried out the global war on terror in response to 9/11? What were they, just computers, like Vulcans? Strictly logical, binary, if then, when then, kind of ineluctable thinking? No, that was all a veneer. Everything that we did in that war was reverse engineered from the humiliation caused by the most powerful country in the world, the most powerful system in the world, having its own technology turned against it. And in this visually spectacular format, having the citadel of American financial and military, the citadels of American financial and military power attacked and blown up. How are you going to get your mojo back after this? Breathtaking acts of destruction. A Martian who really understood human psychology but didn't have any kind of stake in this would have predicted it. On 9/11 itself, oh my God, here's what's coming. There were some cynical aspects, certainly. There were already plans in the works, longstanding plans, to try to depose the Iraqi government. By the way, another euphemism I'm not a fan of is regime. There's only governments we don't like or regimes. We would never describe the Saudi regime, the Egyptian regime, certainly not the American regime. The Economist is the best at this. I mean, you can't get through an article about China or Iran without The Economist dropping at least six regimes to describe the government of these unfavored countries. It's actually very interesting. But but these were longstanding plans to topple the Iraqi government. And so 9/11 became an excuse for that, just like the nuclear. The idea that Iran is, as it perennially, as it has been for decades, is days away from acquiring a nuclear weapon that they will certainly use against Israel. That became the pretext for trying to topple the Iranian government. That's just, that's the way it works. But that's the cynical aspect. The clinical aspect, as I like to think of it, has much more to do with ego and humiliation and concern about, you know, what are the other monkeys going to think? Are they going to think and they can make a run at me now? I better make everybody know that, no, you know, this was a one-off and you mess with me and you're going to pay the price. That's where 9/11 came from.
Right. Well, and it's funny because, you know, an interesting theme throughout the book and throughout this conversation is this idea of of language, of the ways in which it kind of gets twisted. And I think it's fair to say that you have a fairly negative view of mainstream media based on my reading of this book. I think I have a somewhat less negative view, though I think more just sort of procedurally, in the sense that you really see, you know, the idea of using the word regime instead of another one, right? So like there's two kind of reasons, I guess, that would come to mind for why they do that. One is that that is what the governments say. And, you know, they spend a lot of their time. They believe that the U.S. government is legitimate. They quote the U.S. government. That is the initial assumption, right? And the other is that these are people who are sort of brought up in these same systems fundamentally, right?
Absolutely.
They're inculcated into the same ones. And so you have a lot of people and people that I know that, you know, work throughout mainstream press who might even share a lot of the sort of gut concerns about foreign policy, and even like characters that you have in the book who work in defense tech, for example, military tech, whatever you want to call it. They sort of have qualms about these different things, but there's this fundamental way in which they're inculcated into a culture that simply views America as superior to other countries and doesn't really think, you know, much past that.
I totally agree. And in fact, this again relates to a principle of storytelling. If you tell stories long enough, as I do, you start to think of everything in terms of storytelling. It's funny.
Yeah, sure.
But I do think it's inarguable.
This was a free preview of Non-Zero World. To unlock the rest of this conversation and other exclusive content, become an NZN member today at nonzero.org.